I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
I'm Tim McIntosh.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you're listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
It's the second. Sean said his name different.
It was like, I thought it was very like well capped. I thought it was well done.
I know. I thought it ended with a flourish. I liked it. It was just different. And I have to get used to it.
It was the right energy. It was like a little professional, a little, there was
still
a little
relatable.
Bit of, right. Yeah. Relatable, but professional. Like, yeah.
Anchors on the nightly news kind of.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
That's right.
And with sports, I'm Sean Johnson. Right.
No, he's not going to be sports.
Weather.
No, Tim.
He's going to do weather.
Tim's the sports guy.
There's a cold front.
And then Sean's weather.
Coming down from Wisconsin.
Right, right. Tim, I could see you being a weather guy, honestly.
What? A weather guy?
A sports guy. Did I say weather guy? I meant to say I could see you being a sports guy.
But a weather guy?
Hold on. What?
Oh, no. That was just a misspeak.
What happened?
That was just a misspeak.
I was joking around with Sean, like making a playful indictment that he's a weather guy. And I meant it like with the utmost joking scorn, only to find out.
David really thinks you can do it.
To learn that my friend David thinks I'm like a weatherman.
Do you think we have weather people that are listening to this?
No
offense.
We've done the demographic research.
Not a single one.
There's a strong weatherman vibe happening right now with you, Tim. In this, wow. Your dismay is coming across in weatherman. You know,
storm is blowing in.
David thinks a light coat is going to be enough. He's wrong.
Can you do that rant now as a sports guy?
And David accuses me, after all of these years, of doing headlines about LeBron James.
Oh, that's fair.
Nobody are those different at all? Anymore.
No, it's the same. It's the same intonations and everything. I just substituted out. Yeah, weather front for LeBron James.
So what you're saying is that everybody's just the same. That it doesn't take any skill to do any of these positions. It's just are you just suggesting?
And then David accused me.
Is it?
Of thinking everyone is the same. How much longer can we do this?
Probably not that much further.
Probably not that much longer.
Yeah, we're here to talk about The Road. Tim, how are you?
Angry.
Well,
I was doing good before the
previous 3.5 minutes of.
We need to unpack this disdain for weather guys. It's like a cushy job in Atlanta. It shouldn't be that difficult.
Yeah,
like,
these days it's so a upset sinecure. About? Sheesh.
Yeah. So other than that, you're fine though?
Yeah. I'm doing really well. I feel like this is like always parenting corner because I'm a first time father. I've got a little daughter and I always am thinking about like, you know, all these changes that are happening. And today we have a ladder that, you know, goes to our bookshelves.
Yeah.
And Galen sent me a picture of baby up on ladder.
Oh,
she's just like, this is the situation that we're finding ourselves in. This is the direction that we're going. It's just like, yeah, this is the reality. Like, it's hitting us kind of late that like, this is what's on the horizon for us. Mobility.
And how are you feeling?
Heights, broken glass. I'm feeling like a nervous first-time father. Like, I'm in over my head.
They're usually okay.
Sean is so over this. David is so over this. Heidi is so over this. They're just like, oh, wow. Yeah, we've gone through this a minimum of twice each. What? Come on.
It's real, though. It's absolutely real.
Oh, it's real, right, David? Sean is like commiserating with me.
Heidi, how did you, were you worried about this? I mean, your kids are driving now, so I can't imagine.
Like, yeah, that's a different
level. Yeah, Tim, but that's what you got to look forward to.
I feel like there's seriously. Always a level of anxiety
in parenting.
So, like every stage has its own adjustment and anxieties along with it. So,
you just gotta have some confidence in your own vigilance, man.
Do you know who would disdain your worries though? The man from The Road. Who?
Yeah, I was working us back there. Yeah,
he would. Nice.
Could be a lot worse.
Yeah.
No one's trying to eat your kid.
You're complaining about a book ladder, bro. Have you read The Road lately?
Yeah, right. Has your daughter read The Road yet?
She was trying to reach it.
Yeah.
That's what she was going for. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Second read. She wants to read along with.
So today we're going to talk about, eventually we're going to talk about the middle portion of this book. It's the section that ends on page 198. And well, it ends with the most gruesome of the images in this book.
Yeah. Terrible.
And then that of course is the, I'll just read the sentence because I don't know how else to do this, but
yeah,
it says what the boy had seen was a charred human infant, headless and gutted and blackening on the spit. He bent and picked the boy up and started for the road with him, holding him close. "I'm sorry," he whispered. "I'm sorry." So that's the section we ended. I mean, that's where this section ended. Next week, we will read to the end of the book. In this section, a number of things happen. It's a very episodic book, but there's a large section in the middle of this section where they discover a bunker and they rest and they eat, they feast, they bathe, they have a little bit of a taste of civilization, following which they meet an old man on the road who the boy tries to befriend, that will at least provide some sustenance for, and the father and the man have some unusual conversation. And they find a train. They find another bunker that's full of people who they can't save. You know, there's a number of gruesome scenes as you'd expect. And along the way, they run into, you know, they do a lot of hiding. The man's cough is getting worse. He thinks he's got very little time left to live, and he's trying to figure out what to do. What does that mean for his son? And the world is ashen. So that's a quick summary of the section that we just read in a couple of sentences. It's not comprehensive, but it about covers the highlights, or the, if I can use that phrase.
The lowlights.
Heidi, last time we spent some time talking about the mother and your, what was your lack of sympathy, I suppose.
Antipathy,
yeah, for her. Do you feel as strongly about anything else in this book, like anything that happened in this section? Do you have as visceral a response to these other images? And I'm not asking this because, like, these other gruesome images, if you say no, that you think that they're not gruesome, just for the record. But I'm curious about the way different readers respond to these different kinds of images. I used the term impressionistic last week to describe how I think about this book, and that actually has come into focus even more for me. And I want to talk about that later, but I find some of these images to be a bit impressionistic. And I'm as a lead into this conversation, I will just admit that one of the things that I have trouble with this book that makes me not feel as strongly about it as I do I'll say All the Pretty Horses or No Country for Old Men, which, to be fair, are two of my favorite books in the world, is that the impressionistic nature sometimes leads some of these moments and these images to feel disconnected and a little abstract, and I find them to not carry as much weight as they might in other books. So that's why I started thinking about, how does other people respond to this? You had this very visceral response to the mom. Mm-hmm. Do these other things live up to what he does there for you with the mother? And that was a long-winded way of putting the question, but I'm just trying to frame a conversation.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and I agree with you that impressionistic is, I just think that's such a good descriptor for this book. It is different than I think any of his other books that I've read. I haven't read all of them, but there are these moments that shine that leave like a very vivid image. And so that for me, the answer is no, I don't have as strong a reaction to anything in this novel in terms of like judgment. Like, I have like a very great judgment for the mother, and I don't have that for anybody else in this novel. But the images here, with just a few deft sentences, because they're impressions, are so vivid in my mind. But for me, the biggest emotion I feel in this section is suspense. Like, the suspense just builds. Like, I can feel something coming even though nothing's happening. And in those, you know, in between times. And those like liminal times when they're moving, when they're starving, when they're looking, the boy's fear, the man's anxiety, those things are, for me, so emotionally weight, like they're so heavy emotionally that then when what they find is so gruesome, you know, the people being harvested for meat, the babies being hard, like that is so, there's almost a release of tension because something's actually happening. Mm. But the thing that's happening is so distressing that I don't know. It's just so relentless in this section, except for the food. Thank God they found food.
Tim, you were nodding a second ago. What were you nodding about?
It feels like a suspense tale at this point. And part of the reason I think it feels that way is that when something terrible is upon us, with the exception of the episode in the house with the people that are kind of imprisoned there, it's so sudden, just like scary things were upon us without any announcement. And I think the impressionistic nature of it lends to this sort of suddenness of appearance of like danger. Because, I mean, like in a few paragraphs, we see sludge water and ashy snow and another kind of like burned out field. And then all of a sudden, scary guys on road, you know, it's just like there. And so it kind of like, I think the impressionistic nature of the book really adds to the monotony of the days without making the read actually monotonous.
Yeah.
And it also kind of like doubles as like creating this like opportunity for danger to just like impinge on us like lightning from the sky.
Yeah. You turn around a corner and there it is.
Yeah, right.
Sean, how do you respond to those images?
I think Tim described my reaction pretty well. They really do help you feel like you are entering into the monotony of this journey and the uncertain nature of it. But they do punctuate that monotony with these startling and concrete moments. I think the other thing that does that is not just the encounters they have in real time or real life, but the father's dreams are the other way that McCarthy punctuates the narrative with scenes that are more tangible than most of the actual journey.
Well, what's interesting about that is that first section, like last week's section, had a lot of dreams and this one only had a couple.
Yeah.
So do you think that, why do you think there's fewer in, as the book goes on?
I wonder, let's not talk about later, but so far. Yeah, yeah. I wonder if it isn't also to build suspense because there's more commentary about the dreams in this section and maybe fewer actual dreams themselves. Like the boy has a dream he doesn't want to talk about and then he, you know, begrudgingly, or reluctantly reveals that it was of his father dead. He has a dream later that he won't divulge at all. His father tells him, as long as you keep dreaming about these kinds of things, that's a good sign. If you dream about, if you dream of a world that could never be or a world that never was, then that means you've given up and I don't want you to give up. All right. So there's a lot hanging on the nature of their dreams in this section. And I think that's the big, that's one of the lingering questions, right? Is there anywhere that they're going? Right? Are they, like, is this going to lead anywhere? And are they going to find some reason to continue hoping? Or is their hope going to be justified or vindicated? Are they going to lose hope? Is one of them going to lose hope? That's a big, big open question, the whole book at this point.
Cormac McCarthy's only published piece of nonfiction is about dreams. I just think that's worthy of note. I don't want to really side rail us on that, yeah, but
that is worth noting.
Yeah, it states that he takes dreams very seriously.
Yeah.
Interesting for a guy who's obsessed with physics too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hung out with all those people at the Santa Fe Institute and all that. I mean, there's dreams in All the Pretty Horses, No Country. Some of those, the dreams, I think, add to that impressionistic sense too, because you're kind of, it takes you a minute to realize, you know, is this a dream or is this reality?
Yeah, reading it. Right.
So do you think he's trying to, when he introduces these dreams or when he creates this impressionistic tone, and that's just a word I use. I don't want to put like words in his mouth. I don't know that we have a diary of him saying, you know, I was really trying to create something impressionistic. So, but that's just how I describe it. And I guess you guys agree with it enough to roll with it for the sake of conversation. Do you think that he is trying to obfuscate something for us as readers? Like, is he trying to add a layer of mystery or something to the story to leave us wondering like what it's actually about or what the point is or why we're here? Why does he want us to think about why we're reading this? And the reason I ask that is because when you think about, say you think about impressionistic painting, I've talked about this before, there's a self-awareness about their work. You know, when you get up close to an impressionistic painting, like a Van Gogh painting, well, I mean, you know, maybe he's post-impression, but whatever. You look at one of those eras and those paintings from those eras, and there's so much paint. There's so much, they're piling it on there. They're using colors in very specific ways. And when you look at it, it's clear that they're saying, you know, we've got photography to make things look real. So we're going to try to create an experience or you know, an impression of what the world looks like to us. But that then, in so doing, they create an artifact. They're very conscious of the fact that they're creating an artifact. Does it seem like here he is not necessarily trying to create realism and he's trying to do that? He's trying to create an artifact. Like is it self-aware about its novelness? What do you think, Heidi?
I think that the comparison to impressionism in painting is apt. Whether it's intentional or not, I obviously don't know, but it's apt because Monet was, he was like, his stated goal was to create, he was intentionally painting from an atheist perspective, right? Like, I want to show that the world is a disconnected place, that there's these little pinpoints of color that are actually completely disconnected, and we're inventing the image in our own mind. What Monet did was actually completely the opposite. I think he failed in that, because what he ends up doing is that we don't see the disconnected images. We see the beauty. We see the picture as a whole. And we don't think to ourselves, we're looking at tiny disconnected pieces of color. We look and we think we're seeing water lilies in a real garden somewhere. Like, and I think that that's apt for McCarthy as well. This hits you very much in the face with this sense of hopelessness, of meaninglessness. Sean, to your point about the dream, to me, that's the moment that is, that hits that like nadir, right? Of like, don't hope for anything. Once you start hoping, it means you've given up. Like, the paradox of that is intentional. And yet you can't help but craft a story with hope in it. Otherwise it fails, right? Like, at the brink of starvation, they find all this food. They manage to get away. The boy clings to his moral vision that transcends his father's in this section. And McCarthy seems very aware of that. The dissonance between the stark landscape of hopelessness and the miracle of hope. And that, I think, is what, to me, is the main philosophical wrestling in this section. That I'm not sure the author takes a stand on it. He just presents it to us.
Well, I don't know about that reading of like the father not wanting the boy to kind of like dream of another world. I read that as if that begins to happen, the boy is leaving this world. And this world, even in its ashen state, must be given the utmost attention right now in order for them to survive. I'm trying to think if there's an analogy. But I mean, maybe we've seen someone descend into some sort of a mental illness, and they, part of their mental illness is like they're leaving real life because it's too difficult, and they're entering this kind of alternate universe that they're creating in their own mind. And that's part of the thing that drives them mad, is that leaving of the real world behind. And so I read it not as sort of like, don't believe in heaven, or that's a false, you know, rumor. I didn't read it that way. I read it as, you've got to stay tuned to what's happening in the here and now, because there are thorns and thistles and daggers all around us.
That's how I took it too, that you dream about what you are concerned about. And if you stop having troubling dreams, or stress dreams and anxiety dreams, it's an indication that you've stopped caring about this life. And that's when, you know, that's when it's over for you.
I took it that way too, but I think that there's an underlying philosophical statement within there that is like the words themselves are "and abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Yeah. Even, but I think that on in terms of the father's intention, I think I agree. That's how I took it as well. Pay attention is what he's saying. Like, don't slip away. Don't lose yourself. And he is, of course, preparing his son here for him to die.
Yeah.
And the son is also that there's so much subtext in between them in this section that's quite moving.
How would you describe the overriding tone of this middle section of the book? Like, if you had to use one word or two words to describe it, is one of those like teacherly, like, hey, let's talk about this and, you know, the high schoolers or whatever. But I asked this just because I'm curious to see if there's a consistent pattern here. Tim, would you have something on the top of your tongue? Like, okay, so for example, someone could say, man, that section is dark. It's just a dark section. And in a situation like that, you're going to see the final image that we get there of the, you know, the baby, of the infant. If you say, oh, it's just pure dark, it's just a dark section, those kind of things, the people in the basement, they rise to the surface of your experience. Sean, you got something?
I don't know that it's a counter to dark. There's definitely an anxiety that characterizes a lot of the section, just because of how we arbitrarily broke it up. I mean, it is bookended by cannibalism, which is
arbitrary.
Is
dark. Arbitrary speech.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Fair enough. David, for some weird reason, intentionally broke it up so that this section would be bookended with cannibalism. And that is bleak.
I try to do that in every book that involves cannibalism. I try to let you know. Yeah,
right. Hit, punctuate those.
Right. Yeah.
But in addition to the anxiety about being cannibalized yourself or running out of food, there's the continuing anxiety that of the father to prepare his son for his own death.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah.
When you say that the section is marked by anxiety, do you mean that the section, the book itself, is anxious? Like the book is marked by anxiety, like textually, or do you mean that your experience of reading it leaves you full of anxiety?
I think textually, maybe that leads to the reader feeling anxious too. But
sure,
I
would think so. Yeah,
yeah. But I think that there are a lot of ways in which the characters are dealing with anxieties. And I know the whole book is about survival in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Yeah, yeah. And so
you see that it's all as that like anxiety. A subcategory of dark. Is that what you were implying?
No, I just don't think it is the opposite of dark. So I can't Got come it. Back okay. and say, actually, it's a really cheerful section. Although, as Heidi says, right there, there are moments of pretty stark hope. And so in some sense, at times in this section, you almost might describe it that way. Oh, this is a pretty hopeful section. They meet another human who isn't trying to eat them. They find name. With a name. They find a bunker full of food that sustains them. And right, they talk about, they have a conversation about whether there are other good people out in the world.
I'm thinking about your question. I like it. What single word kind of marks this section of the book? I like the one that Heidi nominated, suspense. I think there's maybe two things happening in this section as I read it. One, we are, I think, leaning with the father that we have to have hope about whether or not that house on the horizon might have food. And we have to say no to the boy who is like just so scared that he doesn't even have room for hope. And then at the same time that that's happening, the boy is hopeful about their kind of like their prospects, like their capital P hope, that they're the good guys, that they'll survive this, that maybe there's an opportunity at the end of this long journey to live with other good guys. And so the father is hopeful about like real tangible things and we side with him. And then the boy is hopeful about like the grand things, the big hope that they have. And we have to kind of turn away from the father sometimes in that.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, it's like these scissors that are kind of like a common pivot of just like surviving this life that they're in. And to do that, we have to lean on the father to find food and we have to lean on the son to keep going. I know the father wants to keep going, but I think the father wants to keep going for reasons that even to him are pretty ambiguous, pretty murky, but it seems pretty clear to the boy. And it's part of the reason I think the father like has more hope in the boy in some ways.
Yes.
You know, like the way that he refers to him is like he's, what are the words that he uses? Like he's...
Maybe he's a god.
Maybe he's a god. And there's another phrase, Sean, that he uses... I don't know, like a vessel for the spirit or something like that at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of this is a good excuse for me to bring up apparently the working title for this book. Do you guys know what the working title for this book was?
We're waiting for you to drop that in.
The Grail.
And
like, doesn't it make sense now? Like given where we are in the book, this is like, for me, it feels like a Grail quest.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily to find some chalice of eternal life, but it's almost like, are we going to live our everyday lives in such a fashion as to give voice to hope that there is something else out there for us that's not just ash and marauders?
Yeah, and Tim, I love what you said about the man having this sort of hope and belief about the boy, right? In the Grail framework, I mean, he's like a Galahad. Like he is pure.
Yeah.
And the man seems to partly understand that his mission is to keep the boy alive because he is better than the man, right? In that way, like he sees and values that the boy hopes the best about human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he also knows that his task really requires him to be cynical about human nature
and
to keep the boy safe.
Which is why it's so important that here at the end of this section, the boy finally sees the thing that's terrible.
Right.
There's a lack of a degree of innocence that gets washed away that he's sort of at least somewhat been able to protect him from. Yeah. It's been more abstract, more vague to the boy just how terrible people can be to each other until he sees that.
David, it's so true. And even in that kind of like realizing the boy sees what happened, even there, the father hid something from him. Did you notice that? That like this is like almost fast forward 30 seconds, where the baby came from.
Yeah.
We saw a pregnant woman on the road.
Right.
That's where we're assuming it came from. Okay. Like now we're back to like not terrifying talk. Yeah. The father hides this from the son because the father put it together, but it doesn't seem like the son put it together.
Heidi, do you have a word?
I really love, I didn't know that about the title. I didn't look it up. I wanted to be surprised. I love that a lot. Especially in light of the, like the washing of the boy's hair and the connection with his head as like this golden chalice. But I love that he wrote the book intending to call it The Grail and then changed it to The Road, because The Road is a better title, I think. But I love that throughout it's The Grail, because not only is the boy Galahad, but he's also the Grail itself, right?
Right.
And there is, if that's the case, it makes sense because Galahad's father is Lancelot. And Lancelot is a much more morally ambiguous character. And in the Grail legend, Galahad cannot take his seat at the round table until he defeats Lancelot. And so he fights his father. And he's actually the only Grail knight in the legend who ever defeats Lancelot in a fair fight.
Yeah.
And at that point, he's worthy. And there in this section is a growing conflict between the worldly goal of the father, which is to protect his son. And that's the right goal for the father. There's a proper goal.
Good job.
And the more transcendent moral vision of the son, he must do that because he didn't grow up in a safe world. So he has to be a safe world. And it's that tension, that growing moral tension between the son and his father is so important to this novel. And a beautiful dissonance between what it means to be, to carry the fire, right? To be the keeper of goodness and beauty in the world, to be the one, the only ones that they know of, who are trying to maintain their humanity in the face of these dehumanizing circumstances. And Galahad and Lancelot are like that. Like Lancelot is a very worldly knight. Galahad's a very spiritual knight. And the spiritual vision has to overcome the worldly vision in the Grail quest. And so I think that it's really a perfect, I'm so glad I know that, but I'm also glad they changed the title because it seems that in this, that the road itself, not the destination, is the story.
And for me, I think beginning this book by reading it as a survival quest and gradually watching this transition to it being an even bigger story, for me,
something the anagogical. Question is,
what'd you say, David?
Something anagogical.
Yes, yeah. Right. I think if it had been named The Grail, we'd have been reading immediately for this sort of like spiritual overtones in it. But that's, I think, right. If we just let those rise up from the reading, just like a natural reading of this suspense story, the survival quest, then it's so much more satisfying when that turn happens. We're like, oh, this is about whether or not we should actually have hope. Like whether or not we should actually, what's the right word? Give in to that desire, or whether or not we should just kind of like callous our hearts against people in this terrestrial plane and, you know, get ours the way that everybody else on the road is getting theirs. Everybody else is just looking out for themselves. Maybe we should just give in to that base desire and forget about hope. I mean, I think that becomes the crucial question of the last third, especially of the book. It's all there. That question is everywhere in the book. It just becomes more and more prominent like the horn section in a symphony kind of growing in volume as we get deeper into mm-hmm. the story.
Yeah, that's great. I agree.
This is, brings us back to the impressionistic thing, though, because even if you want to compare it to like painters, a lot of the impressionistic, the works of the impressionists and the people surrounding them were about, they were meant to be about everyday things on the surface, right? You know, it could be a street view, it could be women working in the haystacks, it could be a nature scene, whatever it is, sunflowers and whatever. And on the surface, they seem purely literal, right? But the more time you spend with them, the more the anagogical nature of them emerges. And whereas you look at some paintings from, say, the Renaissance era or something like that, and you look at it and right away you're like, that person is trying to be anagogical. And that's not I'm not making the saying that as a negative thing, it's just a different kind of experience. Yeah. So I think that speaks to maybe that's where the idea of impressionism is happening for me. Maybe it's occurring because you have one thing on the surface, and the more you look at it, the more you identify the brush strokes or however you want to, whatever, you know, analogy you want to use, the more that anagogical, the more that transcendence begins to emerge and shout at you. But at first, you're purely trying to survive. You're just trying to take it all in. And you're saying, oh, look at that painting. You know, look what they did there. And then you have to spend time with it before it reveals what it really is. Sean, what were you going to say? Well, oh, Tim, go ahead, Tim.
No, I wouldn't. Sean, go ahead.
Well, David, what you were saying just made me think of a moment in this section when McCarthy sort of frames that kind of thought process and dilemma when they meet the old man, Eli, or whatever his name is, the man, when he's sort of finally making the decision to give in to the boy's wishes and help the man, he says something like, perhaps he'd turn into a god and they into trees. And this is reference to Zeus going around in the guise of a beggar, and this couple who shows him kindness, are the only people in their village that show him kindness, are rewarded when they die by being able to live together as trees, which, depending on your circumstances, may or may not sound great.
Thanks, question mark.
But yeah, but it is this moment where the father, too, is kind of having that dilemma. Is this just a normal thing, or is there something inside and beyond and deeper to this man that we're encountering? Now, I don't think he actually thinks maybe this guy's Zeus in disguise, but the concept is one that he utters to himself in an explicit way.
Several years ago, I was Hamlet, and I remember the first day of rehearsals, our director gathered the whole cast together, and here's his first address to the cast, right? For Hamlet, like if there is any piece of Western literature in the last 1,000 years that is like dealing with metaphysics and like the grand questions of life, it's Hamlet. And he did something that I really appreciated. He said, this is a revenge story. This is a story of Hamlet seeking revenge, and we're going to play it like it's a story of Hamlet seeking revenge. And I was like, yes, because all of those huge questions just naturally emerge to the audience. And of course, they're sometimes directly addressed, to be or not to be. It asks the question, whether is it better to just kill yourself and be over it? So I'm just kind of like saying the same thing that we're saying in different ways. I love that this book is chiefly about just the drive to live the next day.
Yeah.
And all of the subtleties and questions and dreams and spiritual language that father and son use together just kind of like rise like bubbles, like really deeply in the earth, and they gradually rise to the surface. And I think we're going to see in this last section that we read kind of like what the answer to that big riddle is.
Go ahead, Heidi.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I think one of the things that this book has kind of unearthed, like, a very curious response in me, because it is so grounded in the concrete. Like, I can see them in my head. Like, I can see them in the woods, and I have, like, a very specific wood in my head. I can see, like, the pears in their hand, and I love that. I kept thinking, like, do they have a can opener? I kept thinking that the entire time. He handles that. Thank you, McCarthy. This is, like, I'm in the hands of a master. I can trust the can opener, right? And, like, everything is so concrete. But then, on the other hand, it also, to David, to your point, it feels so archetypal. And I think a lot of that's because they don't have names. They don't have a backstory other than just the impressions that you keep talking about.
And, you don't know where they actually are.
Right. And we don't know, like, where they lived, or the boy doesn't have any memories of his mother, right? So they are, in a sense, still vessels for our stories, right? Like grails, right? They're so concrete, so embodied, and yet also so transcendent at the same time. So much so that then when they encounter this gruesome, horrific, like, to cannibalize a baby, I can't think of anything worse than that. Like, that is the most degraded, like, that's the most you can degrade your humanity. And in that, it's so concrete and also so archetypal, like the cannibalizing of the young, this like grief over the lost generation, the fact that nobody can see color in this world, that also feels so much like a wasteland, the Arthurian wasteland, right? Which feels so archetypal and so relatable, even though we can't relate to those horrific things. But the idea of, like, the lost worlds that we're heading into, the wasteland of modernity, and the loss of the love your neighbor ethic, so that we have substituted we almost are living like a survival ethic, yeah. Even though we have more than we've ever had, right? Mm-hmm. There's this excess. And yet, when was the last time you saw someone truly loving their neighbor, right? And so I'm very curious about that. I've used the word dissonance. That's probably my word for this section. It's very dissonant to me. There's, because everything seems to work, but everything is in opposites. And I just think it's so brilliant. Everything's paradoxical. Everything is both archetypal and entirely embodied in concrete. And I just think it's great.
So we've got anxious, dissonance. Tim, what was the word that you settled on?
Well, I liked Heidi's suspenseful, but...
Yeah.
So I would probably go with suspense, and then for the final third, I'd maybe pick a word like hope, ?
Okay. For the rest of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, not for this section. Well, I think it's coming to the fore in this section.
Before we go, well, I actually would love to read... a few pages here, and it's the conversation between the man and Eli, the other man, and it's on 165. And this, I think, it would go fast if we actually do this. Why don't we do this, Sean? Why don't you be the man, and Tim? Why don't you be the older man? Just not because you're old as,
what do you mean,
that man?
Feeling typecast.
You're just Eli, Tim.
Older than Sean. You're not as old as the man in the story, but you know.
But you might tell someone you're 90 so you could get food.
Yeah.
You're good at playing a role. You know, you're good.
I love canned fruit cocktail in all reality.
Actually, Sean, how do you feel about that as a culinary expert?
Oh, I love it too. The cherry.
Okay.
Oh man.
The cherry is so the grape. It takes on a whole new texture. It's not even.
How do we feel about canned peaches?
Love canned peaches.
I
would rather have them in the fruit cocktail, but canned peaches, give it to me. I prefer canned pears.
To canned to peaches or pears? To regular pears?
No, to canned peaches. I think it's a texture thing, but I would eat them. I would eat either of them.
I will say, yeah, those big canned pears, they're a little more substantial. So you're not like slipping as you're trying to get them out of the thing.
That's right.
Where do you stand on canned fruit?
Canned peaches. I'm not crazy about the fruit cocktail, but it just tastes like the cafeteria in fourth grade.
I'm so disappointed.
I think that's fair. I receive that.
She said so many things in the show over the years. And like,
Heidi.
And right there, she's like, I don't like.
An OFD. I got that on a chemistry lab my freshman year. It was a fail, but my chemistry teacher wrote OFG at the top and said it was my opportunity for growth. And when I questioned him, because I'd never gotten an F in my whole life before. And I was like,
it was the same day she'd eaten the fruit cocktail in the cafeteria.
So that's
now she associated it with failure.
So I went and talked to and that would traumatize me. so I went and talked to my teacher and said, hey, I failed this. And he said it was too flowery, too many adjectives. You're writing a science lab, not an English paper.
All right.
So I had nouns to kill that verbs. Darling.
Nouns and verbs.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And then he handed you the road.
Yeah.
Said, read this and learn how to do science.
And here we are today.
Wow. Speaking of reading the road, page 159, please.
159.
Yeah. Heidi, I don't know.
I don't have a part here.
If the
this
boy,
is not a lady book.
I don't know if the boy shows up.
This is not a lady book.
But if the boy shows up, then I need you to play the boy.
Got it.
So we'll actually just start there. I'll read the bivouacked part. Good word, by the way. I really enjoyed running across that.
Bivouac.
Okay, so if you're reading along with us in the paperback, it's on page 168. And Tim, what is it in the hardcover, the original?
141.
141, all right. So I'll read the narrator here in this paragraph, and then you fellas take it away, and I'm expecting old man. Actually, don't, just be as, like your own artistic choices, Tim.
I just want to
empower you to do that.
Thank you.
Somebody make my artistic choices.
Sean, you do as you're told. okay, here we go. They bivouacked in the woods much nearer to the road than he would have liked. He had to drag the cart while the boy steered from behind, and they built a fire for the old man to warm himself, though he didn't much like that either. They ate, and the old man sat wrapped in his solitary quilt and gripped his spoon like a child. They had only two cups, and he drank his coffee from the bowl he'd eaten from, his thumbs hooked over the rim. Sitting like a starved and threadbare Buddha, staring into the coals.
You can't go with us, you know.
He nodded.
How long have you been on the road?
I was always on the road. You can't stay in one place.
How do you live?
I just keep going. I knew this was coming.
You knew it was coming?
Yeah, this or something like it. I always believed in it.
Did you try to get ready for it?
No. What would you do?
I don't know.
People were always getting ready for tomorrow. I didn't believe in that. Tomorrow wasn't getting ready for them. It didn't even know they were there.
I guess not.
Even if you knew what to do, you wouldn't know what to do. You wouldn't know if you wanted to do it or not. Suppose you were the last one left. Suppose you did that to yourself.
Do you wish you would die?
No. But I might wish I had died. When you're alive, you've always got that ahead of you.
Well, you might wish you'd never been born.
Well, beggars can't be choosers.
You think that would be asking too much?
What's done is done. Anyway, it's foolish to ask for luxuries in times like these.
I guess so.
Nobody wants to be here. And nobody wants to leave.
He lifted his head and looked across the fire at the boy. Then he looked at the man. The man could see his small eyes watching him in the firelight. God knows what those eyes saw. He got up to pile more wood on the fire and he raked the coals back from the dead leaves. The red sparks rose in a shudder and died in the blackness overhead. The old man drank the last of his coffee and set the bowl before him and leaned toward the heat with his hands out. The man watched him.
How would you know if you were the last man on Earth?
I don't guess you would know it. You'd just be it.
Nobody would know it.
It wouldn't make any difference. When you die, it's the same as if everybody else did too.
I guess God would know it. Is that it?
There is no God.
No?
There is no God, and we are his prophets.
I don't understand how you're still alive. How do you eat?
I don't know.
You don't know?
People give you things.
People give you things?
Yes.
To eat?
To eat, yes.
No, they don't.
You did.
No, I didn't. The boy did.
There's other people on the road. You're not the only ones.
Are you the only one?
The old man peered warily.
What do you mean?
Are there people with you?
What people?
Any people.
There's not any people. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about you, about what line of work you might be in.
The old man didn't answer.
Suppose you want to go with us.
Go with you.
Yes.
You won't take me with you.
You don't want to go.
I wouldn't have come even this far, but I was hungry.
People that gave you food, where are they?
There's not any people. I just made that up.
What else did you make up?
I'm just on the road the same as you. No different.
Is your name really Eli?
Nope.
You don't want to say your name?
I don't want to say it.
Why?
I couldn't trust you with it. To do something with it. I don't want anybody talking about me, to say where I was or what I said when I was there. I mean, you could talk about me maybe, but nobody could say that it was me. I could be anybody. I think in times like these, the less said, the better. If something had happened and we were survivors and we met on the road, then we'd have something to talk about, but we're not, so we don't.
Maybe not.
You just don't want to say in front of the boy.
You're not a shill for a pack of road agents?
I'm not anything. I'd leave you if you want me to. I can find the road.
You don't have to leave.
I've not seen a fire in a long time, that's all. I live like an animal. You don't want to know the things I've eaten. When I saw that boy, I thought I had died.
You thought he was an angel?
I didn't know what he was. I never thought to see a child again. I didn't know that would happen.
What if I said that he's a god?
I'm past all that now. Have been for years. When men can't live, gods fare no better. You'll see. It's better to be alone, so I hope that's not true when you said, because to be on the road with the last God would be a terrible thing, so I hope it's not true. Things will be better when everybody's gone.
They will?
Sure they will.
Better for who?
Everybody.
Everybody.
Sure, we'll all be better off. We'll all breathe easier.
That's good to know.
Yes, it is. When we're all gone at last, then there'll be nobody here but death, and his days will be numbered too. He'll be out on the road, there with nothing to do, and nobody to do it to. He'll say, "Where did everybody go?" And that's how it will be. What's wrong with that?
Well, let's stop there.
Jeez, that's so good.
So earlier there's a conversation that they have that kind of sets the tone for this, but here some big ideas are really dropped into, some anagogical ideas are really reinforced here. I like that we talked about that in the last episode of The Warden, the four levels of interpretation and all that, because that's really coming in handy now with the road.
Lay some groundwork.
I mean, I have this section so marked up, we could talk about any given, you know, couplet and get a lot of meaning out of it. Heidi, we'll give them a chance to catch their breath for a second. For you, do you read this section and do you read the encounter with Eli and do you see him? How do you interpret his view of the world, his philosophy, his sense of what the way things are? I mean,
he's pure nihilist, right? Like God is dead and death is inevitable and desirable. And
but?
Yeah, but but Sean, what do you mean by but?
I mean, he's still alive.
Right. Yes.
Everybody, nobody wants to be here, but nobody wants to leave.
Yeah.
And in the end, true. Even in his worldview, death is defeated too, or at least it's left unable to gain victory.
Death starves, right?
Yeah.
What he talks about the boy is just so, it's so good. Like it's like watching Michael Jordan play basketball, right? Like if the boy is a god, what a burden, how horrible it would be to be on the road with the last hope for humanity. Right.
Yeah. Some children of men stuff right there.
Exactly. Yeah. And what a burden that is. Right. So you see the man then in this new light. Like if the boy is the grail, if the boy is the last hope, it is a great burden on the man, on his father. For Eli, the man who he doesn't have a name, right? He has a false name. He has a lying name. And a name that hides rather than reveals. And so in that sense, and he literally says, I could be anybody, right? So he's not actually a particular person. He is a person lying about his identity. So there's so many ideas converging on this conversation. It carries a big hefty punch, and it very much reminds me of Sunset Limited, which is one of my favorite pieces Cormac McCarthy. And as I think it was you, David, that said rightfully that Cormac McCarthy is like the master of dialogue, right? Because there's always subtext, there's always big ideas, there's always this confluence and conflict between representative ideas that are uttered by people in specific circumstances. And this conversation is the only one we really have. That they're talking about something real, and they seem to have certainly lost their ability for small talk. That's for dang sure. Like,
One of the things about McCarthy's dialogue that makes him suited, I think, also for the Coen brothers, which is why they, I think, were the right fit for No Country for Old Men, is that a lot of times the characters don't respond to the things that are being said. And so we get that line where he says, there is no God. And the man says, no. He says, there's no God, and we are his prophets. And what does the man say?
Very famous line.
Well, the man just is like, I don't understand how you're still alive.
Blows it off.
And I want to talk about that transition, because why does the man not respond to there is no God and we are his prophets? And I mean that in two different ways. I think we need to talk about that in terms of like, why does the character respond the way that he does? And then also on a meta level, why does McCarthy have that character respond the way that he does? What does it tell us about the theme, the ideas that he's talking about there by not having the character offer any kind of pushback on that? Like, there's, as a reader, you want to keep that conversation going, right? You want to get some payoff for an assertion like that. There is no God and we are his prophets. But McCarthy withholds that. So Tim, why do you think first that, I mean, you can answer either one of those, I guess, but so there's the meta level, and then there's also just the character level.
I think the man seems to be drifting into insanity a little bit right now, maybe, for the father. Like, who says that? Who says there is no God and we are his prophets? Like, I get the poetry behind it, but it's an illogical statement. It kind of like contradicts itself. Yeah.
So you're crazy. How are you alive?
Right, right. Yeah. I take the father to be like, how could somebody like with your mindset, it's using every like grain of all of my faculties to keep us alive from one minute to the next. You're a little bit bonkers and you're out here the same as us. How is that working? Maybe there's something more to it.
Too crazy to get messed with.
Yeah, there might be something.
Yeah, that's right. Give him the old crazy eye.
That is the most quoted line from this book for sure, like by a mile.
Yeah.
Really?
And oh yeah. And yet it's not. It to me it reminds me we talked about Hamlet already on this episode. To me, it reminds me of like the "To thine own self be true," Polonius, right? As if Polonius the point is often some missed. Kind of, yes, like Polonius is ridiculous.
Except in the case of Polonius, the point didn't miss.
right. Nice.
Too soon.
That's one of those like literary jokes. You want to know your Hamlet to get that one. this man is Eli supposed to be uttering Cormac McCarthy's moral vision? I don't know, right? And so, but it's a compelling statement. If there is no God, surely people on the road running from cannibalism in the post-apocalyptic world are certainly the prophets for this nihilist vision of the world, right?
Yeah.
And so in that sense, on that kind of philosophical, anagogical, cosmological level, you know, the next line that hit the man's answer, "I don't know how you're still alive," it makes a certain kind of dissonant sense, right?
Yeah.
If there is no God and we are the representatives of that, if we are the people proving that there is no God because the world is so bleak and hopeless and meaningless, and we are all heading towards inevitable death and death itself is going to starve, and the boy's mother can't even love her child enough to stay in the world to protect him, right? Because he's so doomed. Then therefore, how are we still alive is a pretty good question and a pretty good response to such a bleak philosophical statement. I'm not convinced that that is McCarthy's moral vision.
Yeah.
But I still think that that moment in the conversation is that response, I think, is supposed to connect with the man's statement.
Yeah, I think you can take it as a direct answer. It may be in a number of ways, because you can also read it as more directly argumentative.
Right.
If you think this way, then explain to me how you're still alive.
Like, right? That's what Tim's saying, right?
Yeah, yeah. He infers that you have only survived because of the kindness of other people. There must be something more here. Or maybe it's just the man still reckoning with his own doubt and frustration. And it's more of a psychological question. Right? If this is your mindset, how have you made it? Right? How has someone, if you think this way, either how have you despaired and survived, or how have you managed to stave off despair for so long thinking the way that you think? Because that seems to be the burden of the man most days.
Right. And to me, it definitely diminishes the framework of this conversation, the punch of the conversation, if the man answers him directly. Yeah. And confirms or denies his statement there.
Right.
He has absolutely to have some kind of ambiguous response to such a statement.
And I think one of the things that makes a great writer is when they have the ability to instinctively understand when a moment like that needs to go unanswered, and then the courage to not answer it, you know, to trust the reader there. And I think that's one of the things that McCarthy's so good at. We should probably wrap this conversation up. We're going a little bit long here. We did spend like 75 minutes looking for pages in the book. But
our listeners will not hear that. Thank you, Logan.
And ranting about weathermen.
Well, that they will hear that. But you mean Tim, right?
Yeah, it's me.
I'm going to lay that one maybe at David's feet a little bit there.
I didn't rant at weathermen. I like the weathermen.
You stir in the pot.
I was trying to give Tim an opportunity to be a sports guy. Tim, any final thoughts? I want to read a passage from a different book as my final thought, because it's an interesting conversation with the road, and I'll explain in a second. But Tim, just wanted to...
I have no further thoughts.
Heidi, anything?
Nope.
Sean, you can still have a final thought.
Nope. I want to hear what book you're going to read from.
Okay, so this book has got me thinking about the Impressionists, the painters. And so I started reading about the same time, actually, a book called Vincent's Books, Van Gogh and the Writers Who Inspired Him. Van Gogh, again, like probably technically not an Impressionist, but he was friends with all those guys. And this book is amazing. It's one of the best books I've read in a long time. It's beautiful, first of all, with full of paintings and illustrations and then images of books. If you like books and you like painters and you like spiritual musings, this is a great book. But he has a letter that there's a little section in this book tied to some of his letters that have me thinking about the road, and they kind of work together. And early on in his life, before he kind of became a full-time painter, he worked as an evangelist and a missionary, essentially, in mining villages. And he himself was beset by a great deal of depression, which ultimately led him to be put into an asylum for a number of years. And then also he ended up committing suicide. But this is what the book says. He felt that the miners needed him. Quote, "You surely," this is still in a letter to his brother, "you surely know that one of the root or fundamental truths, not only of the gospel, but of the entire Bible, is the light that dawns in the darkness. Those who work in darkness in the heart of the earth, like the mine workers in the black coal mines, among others, are very moved by the message of the gospel." He wrote to Theo in November 1878, soon before leaving. At Christmas, he described his new landscape to his brother, white with snow, reminiscent of the medieval paintings by Bruegel. Though there were no paintings around him, Vincent found, as he often did, a mirror of the works of art he cherished, painting and literature alike, stored in his mental gallery in nature. Skipping ahead a little bit, it talks about how he then gave away all his stuff, and he says his faith was not theoretical, it was an unshakable belief in Christ who loved the poor and the needy. In the Borinage, Vincent observed, "It is the poor who befriend the poor," and he wanted to be poor with them, like them. But his talks about how he was too strange for the people that he was working for as an evangelist. So then he writes this: Vincent broke the silence with a deeply moving letter to Theo, in which he revealed his inner turmoil and his struggle to find true meaning in his life. Quote, "Good. Now I no longer have those surroundings. However, that's something that's called soul. However, that something that's called soul, they claim that it never dies and that it lives forever and it seeks forever and forever and forevermore. So instead of succumbing to homesickness, I said to myself, one's country or native land is everywhere. So instead of giving way to despair, I took the way of active melancholy as long as I had the strength for activity, or in other words, I preferred the melancholy that hopes and aspires and searches to the one that despairs, mournful and stagnant," end quote. So I've been reading this book about this guy here who has this great zeal and who also has this great darkness within him. And that darkness, he recognizes that darkness, that the light really matters. And so he tries to go out, and despite how dark his inner soul was, he tries to create as much light for the world, for people who are experiencing darkness. And when I read that line about the melancholy that hopes and aspires and searches being preferred to the one that despairs, mournful and stagnant, I kept thinking about that, this book. And so reading these two books together, that concept is really interesting, especially the idea that one's native country is everywhere, because this book is so abstract in its place. And that allows it to be all of us, wherever we live, wherever we dwell. We can imagine the world that we live in. Like, I'm going to imagine North Carolina being ashen, and Heidi might imagine Colorado. Sean, Florida, but that's pretty much already ashen. Anyway, I just wanted to share that as a coda, as a final thought. It's not totally related, but these books are speaking to each other in an interesting way for me right now. Okay. Truly, any final thoughts, anybody? All right.
No, that was really beautiful. Thank you.
Okay. We will finish the book next week, and we'll dig into the ending. We'll talk about, as Tim put it, hope? Question mark. And then we'll dig into your questions after that as well. And maybe, and I'm thinking next week, maybe we'll do a little letters to the editor segment at the beginning. So if you have any comments or thoughts, be sure to post them on the Substack threads under these episodes. Don't forget, of course, about the Daily Poem. Sean is, he's putting a lot of work there. So is Logan. So go check that out. Don't forget about the mystery stories we're doing over on Close Reads HQ. And then, of course, we also are talking about Kristen Lavrin's Daughter, which is a book that I actually think also speaks to The Road in an interesting way. Maybe it's just that The Road is offering some universal things. So all so these great books all speak to each other. So anagogical stuff, if you will. All right. Well, with that, for Tim McIntosh, for Heidi White, and for Sean Johnson, I'm David Kern. Thanks for listening. Until next time, happy reading.